This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of the show, we will take up a subject we certainly have discussed before on this program, and that is energy, and specifically talking about energy from renewable sources. There was a time, say 20 years ago, when the United States was a leader in renewable energy. However, that is not the case today. Today, certainly the United States lags behind many other countries like Japan and Germany. In this hour of the program, we'll talk a little bit about what we might learn from these countries, and specifically looking at Germany. And our guest for the program is Craig Morris. He is a journalist and a translator who specializes in writing about renewable energy. He lives in Germany. His home is in Freiburg, which is the place that's said to be Germany's solar capital. And we'll be talking about a book that he authored that is now available in English, a book that actually was originally written in German. The title of the book is Energy Switch, Proven Solutions for a Renewable Future. It is published by New Society Publishers and does look at the subject of renewable energy in Germany. So we'll be talking about that, and I'm sure our guest, would be happy to take whatever questions you have and do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 is our number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And at any point here, if you want to call in, you have questions, you can give us a call. Mr. Morris, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you just talk a little bit here in generally about if we look at the major industrialized countries, the United States, countries of Europe, Japan, and look at the role of renewables in those countries, you know, how much of their total energy mix comes from renewables? Can you just toss out some numbers?
Well, we probably would first have to leave out water power. Water power is often considered a renewable resource. And the reason I would leave it out is because, first of all, it's reached its limits in most places. We've had it for so long that we've put up the dams that we need, by and large. And also there's a great environmental impact to hydropower. So when I talk about renewables, and I talk about solar, wind, biomass, geothermal, ocean power, and in those terms, some of the leaders around the world are Austria, Denmark, which has 25% of its power from wind at present. Germany is moving up by about 2% per year. So it was at about 11% last year, and it will easily surpass 12% this year. It may be close to 13% by the end of the year. Spain is booming with wind. Japan was the leader in photovoltaics up until 2004 when Germany took over the lead. But the United States is also booming in wind right now. In fact, the United States is moving faster on wind than any other country. So the U.S. could be and probably will be the world leader in wind by, let's say, 2010, 2015. Mm-hmm. So we are doing things in this country, but the point is that we were the leader in wind back in the 90s, and we lost that lead.
Mm-hmm. And what at what point now, if you think that here in the United States, let's just talk about wind power, for example, if you look at the potential for that, what's the thinking about how much of the total energy mix, you look at all the various sources of energy, could be satisfied by wind?
Well, George Bush himself said at the beginning of the year that that he would like to see 20% of our electricity from wind. And when he was governor of the state of Texas, Texas began its boom. So it's not surprising to see that wind is moving now in this country. I would say that based on the European experience, wind can probably produce about a quarter of our electricity before we have to start redoing the grid, restructuring it, and before we have problems of power storage. For instance, you may have a strong gusts of wind at night producing a lot of power, at 4 in the morning, let's say, when basically industry is shut down and everyone's in bed. So what do you do with all that power? Up until about 20 or 25%, you simply ramp down your coal and nuclear plants that cover your base load, is what it's called. So you can ramp those down a little bit more and keep everything stable on the grid. But if you go up above that, then you end up having excess power in certain parts of the grid. That's been the European experience. Now, let me point out that when I talk about having to expand the grid when we have 20% or 25% wind, let me just point out that we have to expand the grid every time we put up any kind of large gas turbine, nuclear plant, coal plant. So we actually have an added benefit with wind energy and with solar. This is called distributed power. So you have small generators distributed across the country rather than one gigantic facility generating a tremendous amount of power. So we expand the grid every time we put up one of these traditional power plants, conventional power plants. And we only have to do that with wind after we have a substantial amount of energy from that.
You pointed one of the realities that you have to deal with, at least when you're thinking of some kinds of renewables, and that is that your wind turbines will only generate power when the wind is blowing, and if you're using solar, that's only going to generate power when the sun is out. So that you have to deal with the issue of they're only generating power sometimes. They may be generating more than you need, or then there might be other times when you really need the energy, they're not generating any at all. Is it the case that we're going to have a mix of sources? That renewables, would you say that renewables still will never supply all of our energy, so that we're going to still have to think about some of the energy sources that we use now, that there may still, we're still for the foreseeable future, fossil fuels are going to be significant. And then of course, we come to the issue of nuclear power, which is perhaps a whole another subject entirely. Ideally, I guess the question was in a perfect world, what could renewables get you, do you think?
Okay. There's several different questions in your statements. Let me just say that the switch to renewables is inevitable. So we came from 100% renewables in around 1850. We had nothing else. We will eventually go back to that. We will eventually just deplete our oil and coal resources, our natural gas resources, but this is going to be a long way down the road. So we probably don't need to worry about completely running out anytime soon. If we then focus on, as you point out, what the mix should be, we are going to have a mix of energy sources just as we have today. No one is suggesting that we should have 100% coal or 100% natural gas. We have a mixture, and utility companies have their portfolios. So we don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket when we switch to renewables either. To come back to your question of is this a problem that we have intermittent sources of renewable energy? That's what this is called. When you don't switch on wind turbines when you need power. They create power when there's wind, and the solar panels create power when there's sunlight. This is much less of a problem for the foreseeable future than it is often made out to be, for two reasons. One, it's really only a problem with wind energy. Wind energy is the only source of energy that has the potential to create a lot of electricity when we don't need it, such as at 4 in the morning. Mm-hmm. Solar panels don't have that potential. In fact, solar panels will be creating most, they will max out in the afternoon, in the early afternoon, and that happens to be one of the peaked demand times. So, in fact, it would make a lot of sense to start switching over to solar panels to do what in the industry is called peak shaving. That's to say, we have these spikes in demand, and we have to have a generating capacity behind that to meet that peak demand. So we have to build power plants not to generate power all the time, but to generate the power for those 10 or 15 minutes a day when we max out in demand. If we can shave those peaks by, for instance, using solar panels, which will max out at the same time, then we can have we don't have to build additional coal and nuclear facilities to meet that demand. And finally, I have an entire chapter on this in my book because I think it's so important and people don't think about it enough. We always talk about generating electricity, and we can also control the demand for electricity. If you think about, for instance, refrigerators, you could run your refrigerator at times when there is little demand. So your refrigerator could go down a few degrees and store that that cold to bridge the times when there's peak demand. So it would shut off maybe for a few hours at midday, and the temperature would rise slightly. And then it would cut back on again and go down even further to store up that cold to bridge the next day. We can do that with laptops. We could have, theoretically, laptops that just shut off maybe for 15 minutes. There could just be a signal from the power company. You could do this via wireless, and your laptop would switch over to the battery for 15 minutes. You could even have a program that says if your battery is below 50%, don't do it. To give you an example of an application like this, in Austin, Texas, the utility company has a system that you can sign up for voluntarily, and if I'm not mistaken, they don't charge you a monthly fee. You just pay for your power after that. So they waive the monthly connection fee, and they have the ability to shut off your air conditioner if there is a crisis on the grid and they need to lower demand. And experience has shown over the past few years that this only happens a few times a year for just 10 minutes a time. And so residents don't even notice it, but it actually makes a huge difference for the utility company because they don't have to build an entire new power plant just to meet that peak demand.
Mm-hmm. Well, here I think you touch on a couple of things that are really important that I'm sure people in this field say are really important. One is that there ought to be ways that we could make all of the devices that we have that use energy as energy efficient as possible. The other is something that you might, and perhaps connected that with that is something that you might call, you know, strategic demand reduction.
Mm-hmm.
If we could do those things, has someone put a number on what that, how we could say reduce our energy consumption? I mean, if we really did that, if we took that as far as we possibly could, what that would mean in terms of how much energy we consume?
Well, there are two aspects to that. One is just the aspect of spreading out demand over the day. And I don't really see that we're lowering our overall consumption that
mm-hmm.
way. Again, what we're really doing there is saying that we're shaving the peaks and we're preparing ourselves for a future in which we will have more renewable energy because we're running out of the finite resources. So we're going to go that way anyway. And in that future, we will then have to focus more on consuming energy when it is actually being generated, consuming electricity when it's being generated. In terms of lowering consumption through efficiency, the gains are potentially tremendous. Just to give you one example that everyone can relate to, we have 60-watt or 100-watt light bulbs in our homes. About 90 or 95% of the energy that these light bulbs consume is converted into heat. And if you've ever tried to unscrew a light bulb that just blew out, you know what I'm talking about. You can't touch the thing. We have these compact fluorescent light bulbs now that don't use 60 or 100 watts, but 10 or 12. And now they have developed white LEDs. We used to have these little red LEDs or various colored LEDs in our appliances that would just show us that the thing's on, the computer's on when the little green light is on. Those LEDs are now available in white, and you can take about 18 of them and put them in one socket and use that as a light bulb. And that has actually reduced the power down to about 3 watts. So we've gone from 60 to 100 down to 10 to 12, and now we're down at 3. So we can have some tremendous gains in efficiency in our appliances, and there's a lot to be done in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Craig Morris. He's a journalist who writes about renewable energy, and he is the author of the book Energy Switch: Proven Solutions for a Renewable Future. That's about renewable energy and the move to renewable energy in Germany. It's a book that was actually first written in German. It's now available in English and published by New Society Publishers. Craig Morris makes his home in Germany. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Back near the beginning of our conversation, I asked you to talk a little bit about renewable energy in the industrialized world, and you listed off some of the countries that have been leaders in this, including Austria, Denmark, Germany, Spain, Japan, and also you mentioned the fact that wind generation is really growing in the United States. If you take a look at those other countries, Japan and the European countries, if indeed there was a great development and growth in this sector, in this energy sector, was that the result of some kind of deliberate policy by the government, people in government saying, this is something we need to do, so we're going to move in this direction, and then perhaps also provide some kind of incentives to do that? Is that indeed what happened?
Exactly. And that is the big lesson to be learned. If you just take the example of Germany, wind energy began booming over there in around 1990. It started off very, very small, but by the time the Green Party took power with the Social Democrats in a left-of-center coalition, 8 years later in 1998, wind energy had already was already on a great upswing. Now think about that. It started off under a conservative government, the government of Helmut Kohl. Many of your listeners will remember him as the chancellor during reunification and the fall of the Berlin Wall. In his conservative government, there was an understanding that it would be good for Germany to replace energy imports with domestic jobs. They wanted to build up an industry that would create the equipment and the technology that they figured the world would have to be switching to at some point in the future. And at the same time, they would be generating this electricity at home rather than, for instance, importing natural gas to generate electricity from Russia. Some of your listeners may remember that Russia in recent years has started using that as a political tool and manipulating the supply of natural gas to its neighbors. So just imagine you're sitting there and you've got all this generating capacity for natural gas, but your neighbor Russia cuts it off and wants to renegotiate everything. So Germany wanted very early on, and it was signing these contracts with Russia back then in the early 90s. At the same time, they were ramping up wind. And this has happened basically everywhere. Everywhere you look where there's been a shift to renewables, there is an understanding among conservatives and liberals or the left, whatever you want to call them, environmentalists, that this is a good idea. And think about the words we use, conservative. If I am a conservative, I conserve energy. So the problem in this country has been that we have people like Dick Cheney in office who come out and say, conservation will not get us out of this crisis. And in doing so, he is basically saying he is not a conservative. We have a trend in this country, we have an historical legacy in this country, in the Republican Party, of conservatism. What we need is to have these ideas and these schools of thought within the Republican Party. We need to focus on that and foster that kind of thought so that we can move towards renewables. If you look at where we're actually doing that, where we're shifting to renewables in this country, in fact, you will find that it's mostly where, I shouldn't say mostly, but it's at least where there's bipartisan support. You have some of the most progressive energy programs at the state level where there are Republican governors and Republican legislators, and that's where basically you have an understanding that being conservative has something to do with conservation.
We have a caller. Let's bring them into the conversation. They are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
interesting conversation. It seems to me that the urge has been for hundreds of years here in the United States to just find more of everything, be it energy or water or what have you, and that this trajectory obviously leads to severe problems. More recently, here in Urbana, there's been a big hoopla over about increasing electricity prices because of inflation, and it seems that the only thing that really seems to work in reducing or conserving energy use is pricing, and that efforts to fight the price increases lead to actually to people wasting resources in lots of different ways. Could pricing be worked effectively to address the energy problem that you're discussing?
Thank you so much for this call. You're absolutely right, and these are the mechanisms used in Europe. For instance, gasoline costs about $6.50 per gallon in countries like France, the Netherlands, Germany. It's slightly cheaper in Spain, but it's still probably around $5. Think about it this way. If we go in with the approach that we have in the U.S., which is to say don't raise prices, for instance, I'm sitting in San Francisco right now, they had Proposition 87 just in the last election. They were going to tax the oil industry, but somehow they were going to monitor that so that the oil companies couldn't pass on this tax to consumers. Consumers apparently don't like to have higher prices anywhere. But actually, if you go in and you try to do what the CAFE standards did in this country, which is to say Detroit has to build cars that have higher gas mileage. What consumers then do is they buy these cars, and the cars are actually cheaper to operate. They can drive further on less gas. Now, does that encourage them to actually reduce the amount of gas consumed? No. It makes it easier for them to buy more. Okay, so if we go in, we're basically putting the cart in front of the horse and saying we're going to force the manufacturers to make their equipment more efficient without raising prices. The only way to get the amount that you consume reduced is to have higher prices, and that is, in theory, the way it works, and it's also the way it works in practice if you look around the world.
Thank you. That's an important point to make.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's talk with someone else. Also, an Urbana listener, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that all these efforts, while useful, aren't going to counteract population increases. And unless we as individuals think about curbing family size, it's going to negate your efforts. That your efforts will still need to be done, but as the saying goes, every cause is a lost cause unless you control population. It seems to me I keep seeing more and more people having 3, 4, 5 children, and I just don't understand whether these people have their heads in the sand or what's going on. When I was commenting about this, one person said, "Well, what's wrong with big families?" And I said, "Well, you've heard of global warming. You've heard of people using more than their share of the world's resources." I don't know how, there doesn't seem to be a consciousness about this on the individual level at this point for a lot of people. Any thoughts?
Yes, a few thoughts, but probably nothing that is really worth printing. I'll just tell you sort of what my gut reaction is. I don't have a chapter on this in my book, but if you look in the very back, there's a little blurb on the author under my picture, and I say that I like to cycle and eat exotic foods, and I don't want to leave the question of population up to the people who are not concerned about the environment. All right, that's a very sarcastic statement, but basically what I'm saying is if we environmentalists, if that's who we are, if the people who are concerned about population control and concerned about the planet stop having kids, then we're leaving up future generations to the ones who are not concerned about that. So in other words, we're basically doomed to extinction at that point. Now, that's just sort of a thought that I would like to just have us think about. I'm not saying that's the answer. Obviously, population growth is a problem. I live in Europe. Energy consumption per capita is half of what it is in the U.S. So except for the fact that I fly over to the U.S. occasionally, which greatly increases my energy consumption, I basically could have a better conscience than living over here. The question is really not, for me at least, how many children should we have, but what is our ecological footprint, as the term is called? If we have a lot of children, if that's our choice, if we want to have a lot of children, I think we should be allowed to do that. I'm not trying to save the planet so that we can have, I'm not saving the planet for the bugs or whatever. I'm actually very human-centric, so I'm saving the planet for humans. And I'd like to have, I have two kids, and I'd like for the world to be a habitable place for them. So basically, I would like to have a world in which we can get along with the planet, but if people want to have kids, they should be allowed to have them.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're already at our midpoint here. I want to introduce again our guest, Craig Morris. He's a journalist and also a translator who specializes in renewable energy. He makes his home in Germany. He lives in Freiburg, which is it's described as being Germany's solar capital. He is the author of the book Energy Switch, Proven Solutions for a Renewable Future. It is published by New Society Publishers. Was actually originally written in German and is about concentrating largely on the German experience with renewables, and that's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to, before we took the last couple of callers, we were talking a little bit about, I asked you about whether whether in the countries that we're talking about, the European countries, where they really moved to try to develop renewables, whether that was a process of a deliberate decision to do that by the government, and you said yes, that was, and that it was one thing that we could learn. In, let's say, again, take Germany. Specifically, what did the German government do to try to, first of all, encourage the development of of the renewable industry, so encourage the design and development and building of wind turbines and also of photovoltaics so the products would be there? And then what did they do to encourage German consumers to then go out and buy the technology and bring it into their lives?
I'll try to explain this. These are policy issues, so it's not that easy to explain. But if you want to learn more, you can take a look at my book. Basically, if we take a look and just compare, we could compare wind and solar, excuse me, and get a good idea. Wind energy in the U.S. is booming because utility companies are putting up gigantic wind farms, hundreds of turbines generating hundreds of megawatts, because that is the size that utilities are used to thinking in. When they put up gas turbines, coal plants, stuff like that, they're used to thinking in terms of maybe 600 megawatts. So now they're putting up 200 megawatt wind farms. They say they're doing this, and the U.S., if you talk to U.S. policymakers, they'll say this is more efficient than putting up two or three wind turbines, which is what you have in Germany. In Germany, you have maybe a village of 20,000 people. They get together at a town meeting and say, you know what, if we all chip in $5,000 or $10,000, we can afford to put a turbine up on the hill. And we've had some wind experts out here, and they say the wind conditions are good. This is what the project will cost, and we will be generating enough electricity to meet all of our demand. So we can basically say that we are meeting all of our energy, all of our electricity demand with renewables, just with this one wind turbine. Now, from the U.S. perspective, this is not efficient. But let's talk about the policies behind this very briefly. Mm-hmm. There's a tax credit in the U.S. Now, it's called a tax production credit. That's the policy that's behind the wind boom. The problem with this is that the people who benefit from it are the people who pay large amounts of money in taxes. So if you have a great tax burden, If you're a profitable corporation, then you can invest in wind energy to reduce your tax burden. But what if you're just a normal guy like us? Well, you have to work through one of these corporations. You can't actually get involved so directly yourself. So there's more of a bottom-up movement in Germany because the mechanism has nothing to do, or I don't want to say it has nothing to do with taxes, because obviously it affects everyone. Your investments affect your tax burden in Germany as well. But the mechanism is directly related to the size of the turbine and how much electricity it produces in Germany, whereas it's more directly related to your tax burden in the U.S. The same thing with solar power. You were actually paid you're paid in Germany for the amount of electricity you generate, regardless of how much you consume. Now, in the U.S., we have a different system. It's called net metering. And basically, I'll simplify it, your meter runs backwards when you produce more energy than you consume. Now, what happens if you hit zero? Well, your power company can then decide that it simply won't pay you anything for the excess power that you produce, or it can say we'll only pay you half of the retail rate. And notice that in the U.S. system, you get paid basically just the retail rate to begin with. In other words, when your meter runs backwards, you're basically just getting paid at the local retail rate for the power that you generate. In Germany, you get paid based on what the solar panels cost. So your retail rate might be 13 cents in California, or it might be 19 cents in New York City, or it might be 6 cents in Wyoming. And so you see that solar power really doesn't pay for itself in certain parts of the U.S., whereas in Germany, you go out and buy a solar panel. Well, one particular solar panel might cost you 4,000 euros, and that's going to cost you that much all over the country. So that's what you get paid based on the power that that panel generates, regardless of whether you're in Munich or Berlin. And over here, it varies according to the retail rate. Again, if that's too complicated, I have a longer explanation of this in my book, but that should give you an idea. The general focus is it's a bottom-up approach. Consumers are allowed not just to consume this energy, but to generate it themselves, so that just normal people like you and me can become power generators.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other people who are listening. We have a couple of Champagne folks here, and we'll go to line number two in Champagne. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right on point about lessening the footprint, and also the real way to reduce consumption is through market forces such as carbon tax, that sort of thing, to increase the price. But I wanted to address the population issue that the woman brought up just a little while ago. That it might seem counterintuitive and or ironic, but it seems the most effective way to reduce population growth is prosperity. And it's those parts of the world where people have a greater degree of prosperity where the population growth is reducing. For instance, in Europe and Japan, the people are actually having fewer children than what would be needed for replacement of the population. And we're very close to that here in this country. It's the poorer parts of the world where people are having, the biggest explosion in population. And whatever the mechanism that causes that seems to be the reality. So to the extent that we could bring more prosperity to the entire planet and all people while creating a smaller environmental footprint, it seems like we would get to reducing our population more quickly.
It's a very interesting point. It's as I mentioned with the last caller, it's really totally outside of the scope of my book. But you're right, it's a double-edged sword, because essentially we're talking about the prosperity as the problem, because it's basically goes along with greater energy consumption, and at the same time, the greater prosperity seems to reduce population growth. All I can say is that I recently read a few months ago a report that said, just a newspaper article, I think, that said that the population growth globally seems to be slowing down because of the great growth in the emerging countries of Southeast Asia, and maybe it was also South America. So it's a complicated issue, but I'm just not really an expert on it.
Okay, well, it's just another way of, you know, thinking about things. And if we had a more egalitarian world and, you know, a higher consciousness about how to live lightly on the earth, then maybe a lot of our problems would melt away.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on to another caller. This is Champagne in line 3. Hello.
Yeah. Going back to the other one, in terms of America, you know, it's the energy companies, it's corporations, and you know, unfortunately, that's the direction we go. The other one makes more sense. Actually, the main one was in terms of passive solar heating. I think Germany is somewhat of a leader in that, isn't it? Where, you know, in other words, the one side of the house is all glass, and you pick up energy.
Yes. I'm not sure that Germany is one of the leaders here. The U.S. is doing a lot. There are projects over here as well. I'm trying to think if it's the LEED, L-E-E-D, standard. But there are houses and architects and planners over here that have the same designs. In fact, I could sum this up and say that Germany really doesn't have anything that we don't have, except for the will and the determination and the commitment to implement this stuff on a large scale. But to just explain to your listeners what your caller is talking about, it makes a lot of sense in the Northern Hemisphere. If you need a lot of heat in your house, I'm from New Orleans, so we would not want to do this there because it's too damn hot anyway. But up in Illinois and certainly in Germany, we don't really use air conditioning as much as we use heaters. So what you would do there is you would build a house that's facing the south, have mostly glass on the front, seal off the back of the house more, and allow the light to come in the winter. You can put up a deciduous tree in front of your house so that in the summer the tree will absorb a lot of the sunlight, so the house doesn't heat up too much. The leaves will fall off in the winter and let the sunlight through. And then you can have balconies, or you can have the roof, the eaves, sloping over the front of the house a little bit to provide additional shading when the sun goes up higher in the sky in the summer to protect the house from overheating. So it's a combination of high-tech windows with triple glazing, three panes of glass behind each other. In fact, there's a whole residential area in Freiburg that has these houses. If you go up and touch the window on a cold day, they feel like room temperature. There's just no heat escaping. There's no cold coming in through the windows. And these houses in Germany, which is roughly at about the level of the border between Canada and the U.S., so that's pretty far north, these houses in Germany make do with one heater, one small heating unit in the house. They use very little energy to heat the house, and they have solar panels on the roof. So over the year, they actually produce more electricity than they consume. And I like to call them residential power plants. It doesn't sound like a very enticing term, but if you take a look at the houses, it's a very interesting concept. And just think about that. You could have residential areas that actually produce more power than they consume. And we have that already in an entire subdivision in Freiburg.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. I think that one of the important points I think that you make in the book is that certainly technology is important and technological development is important, but also public attitudes are important, maybe as important, maybe more important, because the technology can be there, but if people aren't persuaded that it's important, then they're not going to take to it. In particularly in places like Germany, did the government do something to try to develop a public consciousness around these issues and to channel that into demand? Or did it go the other way around and that there was, in fact, public consciousness and there was demand and that then the government tried to develop policies that would respond to that?
You know, honestly, I think it sort of worked in both directions. I think the government does a little, and I think there are citizens groups and NGOs and research organizations that also work on public awareness to a certain extent. But probably the biggest difference is that Germany is just more desperate than we are. Let me give you some figures. Germany imports 97% of the oil that it consumes. The figure is roughly the same for Japan. In fact, it's probably more like 100% for Japan. In this country, we only, I say only, import 40% of the oil that we consume. Now, we're very concerned about that over here, and we should be, because basically that figure is only going to rise. We peaked in oil production at this country, I believe, in 71 or 72. So we're just going downhill from here, and we're going to become more and more dependent on not only on oil imports, but now we're switching to natural gas imports. The only thing that we really have in this country is coal. Coal is filthy. It's the dirtiest form of energy we have, so it's a mixed blessing to have the largest coal reserves in the world as we do. The only thing that Germany has is coal, so they were simply much more desperate than we were. The energy dependence that we are just now entering in this country was very clear to Germans. They were in our predicament already 15 years ago when they began this revolution. And maybe that's the reason why we're starting to get into that now again here, is that people are talking about energy security, people are talking about energy dependence, and we're beginning to realize, hey, we can have homegrown energy, we can have solar, wind, biomass, et cetera, and then it doesn't matter so much what's going on in the rest of the world. Yeah.
Well, you're talking about the fact that there was this point at which the German government said, looked at the situation, looked at the demand for energy, looked at these energy imports, and said, we need to do something about this. We can't be that dependent on imported sources of energy. It's expensive. It's problematic. The supplier could decide to turn off the tap, and then where would we be? So there was this commitment to move towards developing an industry around renewables, and that had the additional benefit of creating an industry and creating jobs. So
right.
Now in Germany, what sort of industry, what part of the economic sector of Germany is involved in renewable energy?
Just to give you an example, the towers for all the windmills we have in Germany, the wind industry is now the second largest purchaser of steel in Germany behind the auto industry. And of course, Germany is, most people in the States, when they think of Germany and industry, they probably think of Mercedes and BMW and Porsche and Volkswagen. So you can imagine how big that must be if the wind industry is now number two behind these automakers. And the thinking really is, as you pointed out, it's about having these jobs at home. So if you're switching to renewables, and in this country we talk about, oh, it's too expensive and all of this, but the point is that it may be expensive, but it's expensive because of all the jobs behind it. We're talking about something like 150,000 jobs behind renewables in Germany, and that figure is growing rapidly. And so you may have higher energy prices at the gas pump on your electricity bill, but you'll be earning more, your neighbor will be earning more, the economy will be more prosperous. And that's the kind of switch that Germany wants to have.
Mm-hmm. And I would assume that this would be also a source of export possibilities for Germany. That is, they could, not only are they selling the technology within Germany, but there's the potential to sell that technology abroad.
Actually, they've already moved in that direction. The country basically has exhausted its wind potential, and growth in wind is declining within Germany, but the industry is booming because of the exports. The United States has the largest trade deficit in the world. Germany has the largest trade surplus in the world. So they produce the most while importing the least. So they're looking around at the world and saying, what are the products that the world wants to have? Let's do the R&D on this. Let's set up our industry to manufacture these products that people are going to want to have 10 and 20 years down the road. And this is something that the U.S. needs to pay attention to. We miss the hybrid boat over here. So when you go buy a General Motors car now that's a hybrid, you're actually paying a patent fee to the Japanese. And we risk doing that now with solar and wind and lots of clean tech if we lead this up to Europe.
All right, we have about 5 minutes left. We have several callers. We'll try to get at least one or two. First in line, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hello. Since you covered the sort of the some of the policy things, you know, we here energy has to be centralized, and the idea of a suburb creating more energy than it absorbs is like the probably a nightmare for the people that are investing in the current system. So I think that's something to dwell on at length. But since you've outlined that already, what about the competition between different photovoltaics? I just heard on the BBC, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. Can't believe everything here on the radio, that Germany is the biggest importer of photovoltaics from China. So they're actually Siemens or whomever is making them there. Are they? That has implications as far as maybe helping the Chinese go solar quicker if there's a technology transfer that could happen over there. But I'm just wondering how many different competing systems and solar shingles were available in Japan a while back, where you just nail them on your roof and the contact is made. But what kind of things are happening in that regard, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, you're talking about the supply chain, and you're absolutely right. The solar silicon is generally made in Southeast Asia. It's the same thing with the IT industry. We don't really think of the IT industry in this country as something that's not helping our economy, but we certainly import some of the raw products that we use to make the processors and then make the computers. But the companies like Dell and IBM, those are the big players. The supply chain can be partly in foreign countries. But let me just explain what's happening in the solar industry. They used to buy silicon from the processor industry. They used basically waste silicon from the processor industry to make solar panels. Now, because the industry is booming, they're having to create it on their own. So yes, we're importing from Southeast Asia, but there's also a growing industry within Germany, and it's just being set up because of this crunch. They're starting to actually produce these products within Germany.
All right, let's get one more call here. Line 3 in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, I was just in Germany, and I lived there in the 70s. And I just want to say that the energy awareness is available, is visible to the naked eye. Soccer moms ride their bikes to do their grocery shopping. Soccer kids ride their bike to soccer practice, or they take public trans. Families with two professionals have one car because they can take public trans to work. Everybody puts all their recyclables in their yellow sack and puts it out on a certain day of the week. Joe Sixpack recycles, you know. Just the ordinary citizen is aware of this, and I guess it's just because they're more crowded. But you don't have, everybody does it. You don't need to convince anybody.
Where is this?
Germany.
Yes, okay. I thought you were talking about somewhere in the States.
No, I said I was just in Germany last month.
Yeah, it's that way in Germany. It's that way in the Netherlands. It's, to my understanding, it's that way in Scandinavia. It tapers off a little bit as you go down to Southern Europe.
I have Swiss relatives, and they tell me they're supposed to turn off their car if they're waiting for more than 6 seconds at a railroad crossing or an intersection.
Oh, sure. One of the culture shocks I have over here is how people leave their cars on for 2 or 3 minutes at a time. If they stop somewhere to ask for directions or whatever, I have this reflex. If I hit the brakes and the car stops, I cut the car off. And a lot of people think that it takes so much gas to start up the car that you basically have to have the car off for a minute or two before it even pays for itself. And that's just not the case. It's probably closer to about 10 or 15 seconds.
Well, the other thing is, it's not just the use of the energy, it's also the pollution that they're concerned about. In Switzerland, they're very concerned about their pristine mountains.
Right.
So thanks very much for the program.
Okay. Thanks. Well, again, that goes back to this question about public attitudes and where they come from and how you develop them and how you develop in people that level of environmental consciousness. And I think here in the United States, it's if you go out and you ask people, do you think that the environment is important, and are you doing some things that you think benefit the environment, I'm sure that people will say, well, yes, we think the environment is important, and we're trying to do things and, you know, whatever, you know, they'll talk about recycling, or they'll talk about buying a hybrid car or whatever. I don't know how it is that you how you build on that, though, and how you move to some kind of even more significant commitment than we would have now.
Well, you're absolutely right that people would say that they're interested in the environment and they want to protect it. That's what all of the polls show. What we really need to do is just talk about, on a day-to-day basis, how we consume energy. We need awareness of how we consume it, when we consume it, and how much we consume. And just to sum this up with the example of the light bulbs again, your 100-watt light bulb is basically a heater. It just happens to produce light with 5% of the energy that it uses. And think about this. If you're in a place where you're running an air conditioner and you have your lights on during the day, you're creating a lot of heat within that house, and that's going to actually raise your air conditioning needs. So the more you have these little light bulbs on using all that electricity, and creating all that heat with the electricity, the more you have to use your air conditioner. So if we start thinking in terms of those relations, then we can make a lot of progress.
There we must stop. We come to the end. If you want to read more on the subject, you can look for the book I mentioned a couple of times. The title is Energy Switch, Proven Solutions for a Renewable Future, published by New Society Publishers, looking at renewables in Germany. Our guest is Craig Morris. He's a journalist and translator who specializes in renewable energy, and he makes his home in Germany. He lives in Freiburg, which is the place that they say is Germany's solar capital. Mr. Morris, thanks very much.
It was a pleasure.